14th of November, 2006, from the Mantor Laboratory of Parasitology. Today, Agustin Jimenez Ruiz, collection manager in the Mantor Lab, is going to speak on parasites, collections, and natural history, and the development of natural history collections over time.
Today I'm just gonna, I'm gonna tell you things that you already know. And I'm gonna be really proud to present those things to you, because it's basically the things that we do every day. The things that are here might be exciting and stuff. Our life is not as exciting as these guys or these folks did. Basically, the purpose that I want to achieve today is just like reiterate that museums are really important, that expeditions are fundamental to collect data, that all the information that you collect from those expeditions are going to be used by somebody in some way that probably you didn't mean to, but everything is going to be used. So you have to take like good data of your collecting and receipts, keep receipts always. We're going to highlight the value of the collections. Probably that is another thing that what I'm going to do from now on till the day I pass out or away. And reiterate the importance of discussing your ideas with peers and actually getting that thing and publish the paper as fast as you can.
You say with peers or with peers?
But.
Did you say pass out or pass on?
What?
Did you say pass out or pass on? Is it pass out related to
No, peers? I said pass out as because I was thinking of peers, but then I corrected to pass away, meaning until the day I die.
Okay.
So, well, the definitions of the museum, you can find them in any dictionary. The definition that I like the most is the actual origin of the word museum, derived from the Latin, that is a place, it's sacred and is dedicated to the muses. So if you go to a museum, you are gonna get inspiration from the muses. Whatever you choose those muses, they have to be. And then from here, we're going to talk about the time in which, like, museums in the Americas, get pretty much the kickoff. Well, it wasn't exactly the time, but we're going to have one of the persons that impulse the museums and the Philosophical Society of America a lot. Not only impulsing them in terms of I'm here. This is there is your land. You can go and do whatever you want. But actually, President Thomas Jefferson was an active member of this society, and he, as other people that were the so-called American founding fathers, were involved in that philosophical American society. This is the part that you guys know very well, and I bet that you guys know better than I do. But what? El presidente Jefferson le dijo al capitán Lewis, capitán Lewis, tienes que ir en una expedición a encontrar la salida al Pacífico, porque estamos a punto de comprar un gran pedazo de tierra que está en el medio del continente. Le dijo, aquí hay $2,500, ve, arma una expedición y conquista el oeste. El presidente, el capitán Lewis trató de buscar ayuda y encontró la ayuda de William Clark, que era otro militar también que tenía una base en el estado de Kentucky. Entonces se fueron. Y lo que trataban de hacer era encontrar la salida al Pacífico por el río, el Snake va por acá, el Columbia va por acá, el Colorado va por acá. Pero la encomienda era, mira, con fines comerciales tienes que ir y tienes que buscar cuál es la salida al Pacífico. porque la tenemos que conectar este lado con este otro. Así que agarra tus $2,500 y ve. Ellos agarraron y se fueron en esa expedición, y en esa expedición se dedicaron a hacer un montón de observaciones en la historia natural de la flora y fauna que se encontraba en medio del continente americano. Y como parte de esas observaciones, bueno, olvido una parte muy importante, es que Lewis, a pesar de que el capitán Lewis era miembro de la American Philosophical Society, sin embargo, él se vio forzado a tomar clases de astronomía, de geología, de botánica y de zoología. Y todo esto lo hizo en un espacio de 3 meses en la ciudad de Filadelfia.
What does sin embargo mean?
What?
You said sin embargo.
Sin embargo, however.
Oh, okay.
Él tuvo que estudiar astronomía, botánica y geología. ¿Se pueden imaginar?
Geology.
Y él, no sé, luego yo estaba leyendo partes de su biografía y me quedé pensando, ¿se pueden imaginar al capitán Lewis diciendo, no voy a estudiar ese trabajo de rocas metamórficas porque tengo que conquistar el oeste? No, él agarró y lo hizo. Estudió sus 3 clases, las terminó, y agarró todo su grupo de gente, a su grupo, y se fue hacia el oeste. Ya no avanza. Bueno, las expediciones que él realizó hacia esta parte, en muchos casos sí fueron revolucionarias, sobre todo en encontrar rocas y en encontrar flora. En fauna, los españoles ya habían mandado muchos de esos especímenes, se los habían mandado a Linneo y los tenían ya en Europa. Pero hubo una cantidad impresionante de especies nuevas que descubrieron. Sin embargo, mucha gente usó las notas de campo del capitán Lewis y Clark para realizar expediciones en el futuro. Entre ellos estuvieron las expediciones de Say y Purge y este otro sujeto. Pero bueno, aquí hay algunas de las plantas que describió Purge en su obra America Septentrionalis. Él estuvo en Filadelfia, en el Museo de Historia Natural. Él era un ciudadano inglés, pero radicó acá en América para hacer sus estudios. Y esta fue una de tantas especies que describió. Colectaron algunas pieles de mamíferos. La mayoría de las pieles que colectaron en el campo, a veces las usaban para comerciar con los nativos. Y algunas otras también fueron tomadas de vuelta, remitidas de vuelta hacia a Filadelfia, para que fueran ingresadas a los archivos de la American Philosophical Society. ¿Por qué incluí? Este fue uno de las observaciones que tal vez impresionaron mucho a Lewis and Clark. Esta es a pronghorn, no, en español, no me acuerdo cómo se dice.
Entelocaptor.
That's the genus. And actually, that day, the first sight that they ever had from this animal, the first report that an American did was on the mouth of the Niobrara River on a morning of September. So that was the first report that Captain Lewis writes. We saw like an antelope-like. Cervid-like animal that moves fast as the thunder, and I don't know, I'm exaggerating a lot, but the first sighting that they made for this animal was in Niobrara River. They already had described that thing because the Spaniards were like shooting everything in the southwest, and then they shoot like a bunch of these animals and send some to Linnaeus and some others to Madrid. But in Madrid, there weren't that many animals. So these are the expeditions that I was telling you. Nuttall and Say used their field notes to say, okay, this is what we know now. Okay, we're going to go and redo re-explore the very same areas, and then we are going to bring the specimens back to Philadelphia and describe a lot of the species. So that's what they did. But remember, the purpose was actually to find the other way from here to the Pacific. Okay, what is the connection and stuff? And that time, this is, remember, this was the Louisiana Purchase. They got this bunch of land, and then they were claiming to the King of Spain, okay, you know what, King of Spain, Carlos IV, was the King of Spain on that time. This land is ours. It's ours. And then the King of Spain, from his comfy chair, was saying, no way, the Sabine River is your territory, and then you keep it that way. And all the other, the one in the north, well, that's your problem to deal with. Let me in my coffee chair. And then the discussion was going and going and going. The president, well, President Jefferson was on the need to find more information about these lands that he was pretending to acquire. I mean, through the Louisiana Purchase, it wasn't clear, the status of this land for him. So he actually wanted to know what was there. So fortunately for him, a couple of Europeans were wandering around the continent and the middle part of America, they started in 1799. They left Europe, and then they arrived to Venezuela. And then for 4 years, they were wandering through the Orinoco River, and they were just like killing animals and just like collecting plants. And then they were actually constructing the foundations for what we know of what is there in America. Like several people that has worked on the biography of Alexander von Humboldt called him the scientific discoverer of America. I think that that's a little bit too much. But that's one of the titles that they assigned him. And this guy here was Aimé Bonpland. Aimé Bonpland was a botanist trained in Paris. And then he actually collected and did the actually preservation of all the plants that they were collecting. And Humboldt was doing the shooting and skinning. Humboldt was trained in probably the best university or the best place, one of the best places to study science in the 1700s, which was the University of Göttingen. And down there in Germany, he was studying with like people that were discovering like chemical elements, that were like actually naming like mountain range after them. And things that people that were like really involved in the doing of science. These guys didn't sit down and read. These guys could sit down, like, okay, I get bored from this book, I'm gonna find another book. They kept reading, and then they just happened to have an idea, and then they say, okay, let's go and do it. And I mean, luckily for them, they were rich, because it coincidentally happens that if you happen to have the money to go to a university in that time, you happen to be like enormously rich, as Alexander von Humboldt. He just like say, okay, let's go to Egypt and let's just start doing like stuff. What kind of stuff, his friends usually ask him. And he said, just like scientific stuff, man. I mean, we're gonna be there and we're gonna collect like the flora and fauna that is represented there. And we're going to make a bunch of observations on the natural history of the place. And then probably some of his friends, probably somebody that was over said, well, you know what, it sounds like a good idea, but Egypt is in the middle of a war right now. So So we cannot go there. Okay, then let's go to the Pacific, was his second idea. And then the French were like, the French government was like kind of like trying to pushing him, yeah, go to the Pacific and find out what is there, and then if you die from mysterious disease, it's not our fault, it's your fault because you wanted to go there. And then another circumstance happened, that the French government just backed off from that chance to send von Humboldt to the South Pacific. And then they said, okay, no, you know what, we're not going to give you that ship that you need to go to conquer the world. So you just find your way. And then Alexander von Humboldt was kind of like so excited and so into the thing that he was discussing with Bonpland. And Bonpland and him devised this plan to go to the Spanish America. And then to go to the Spanish America now sounds like a really kind of like trivial thing to do, you know? Like, we can go and just like, we require a visa, we want to go to Brazil. Well, in case that you're American, you require a visa to go to Brazil, or you require, I don't know, like, you jump across, like, Canada to go to Cuba and do stuff. But if you want, you just go. But back then, that wasn't the case. Because the King of Spain was kind of like, you know, like those free controls that didn't want people just, like, coming over and survey what was in their land. It's as if I tell, like, Gabe, hey, Gabe, can I go to your house and just, like, do a checklist of the stuff that you have in your garage? Probably Gabe is going to say, okay, and then just, like, make sure that you clean up everything after you. Or probably he's going to say, no, you know, I mean, this is my house.
You would clean up my garage just by making a list?
That would be an interesting garage to do. I'll do it.
Gabe, do you have a garage?
Come into the enemy's garage.
Carport.
That'll work.
See?
I like that idea.
So that's going to work. But basically, he was the King of Spain, Carlos IV, didn't think of like the Spanish America as a garage. And he thought of it as a valuable thing to keep. However, what Carlos IV had in mind, I mean, this was like a 18th century man, thinking on like liberalization of ideas, and actually illustration and enlightenment and stuff, and actually go there and do stuff and make it public to the people. So based on that foundation, and because Alexander von Humboldt happened to be friends with the consul of Saxony in Spain, so they were Prussian, so lots of names get changed. But okay, he wanted to, he knew somebody that knew the king, and then from that bridge, he used that bridge to get that permission. That's the way you did it in the old days. And then you would write like a letter, a formal letter saying, well, I mean, this is, my name is Alexander von Humboldt. I'm a humble scientist that happens to have this objective and this aim to go and survey the lands that you have, like in the equatorial area and stuff, and I would like, but in a very polite way, as opposed to the way that you should say, like, okay, this is who I am, this is what I do, give me the permit. This is the, that is the check. You know, it's kind of like a little bit different. So Carlos IV said, okay, that's fine, just go, and then I'm just going to give you a Spanish passport so you can show up that you're Spanish in case somebody stops you. You just show that thing, and then they have to let you go. And I'm just going to write you a letter saying that any Spanish officer has to help you in any means to, like, get your objectives. So Carlos IV was really, really kind of like in the mood of, okay, yeah, let's go and discover, yeah. And then von Humboldt was going wandering, and then he just like traveled from, it was quite, I didn't put the map, but he arrived to Caracas, and then he just like crossed the Orinoco, and then he just like happened to cross the Andes, and then went to Ecuador, and then to the Guayaquil Pacific coast, and then he went up to Colombia, and then he went to the Caribbean, and then he went back up to Guayaquil in Ecuador, and then from there he took a ship to Mexico, and in Mexico he crossed the land, he crossed it again, and then he went north, and then he went south, and then he went back to Mexico City, and then he jumped to Cuba, and in Cuba he spent like few weeks, and like 4 months, and that was the time in which he said, okay, that's enough. We have a lot of material to take back to Europe. And then he just happened to interview with the American consul the American consul in La Habana in Cuba. And then he said, von Humboldt said, okay, you know what? I really admire this guy that you have for president. And he had a genuine admiration for President Thomas Jefferson because, well, he happened to be kind of liberal and had all these kind of wild ideas about freedom and stuff and those kind of things. And he wrote a manuscript that was named maybe it's on my cheating mode. No, it's not on my cheating mode. No, but it's Notes on Virginia. I don't remember when he published that thing. Or that manuscript, but he published the Notes on Virginia. And von Humboldt actually used that format to make his writings for the entire lands that he had crossed. So he was there, so he wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson asking him for an appointment. So, but in his letter he said, you know what, I just came from Mexico, and then, I don't know, probably in your busy schedule you can make a room for meeting me, and probably we can chat and share like the knowledge that we have, because Jefferson was also a naturalist, you know, and then he discovered a mammoth tusk and stuff, just as Humboldt had done in South America. So he was kind of introducing that, you know, we have lots in common, and it might be a very good idea for us to meet. Plus, I know what's like in the border, like down there in Mexico, that land that you are kind of claiming, I have the information in my notes. So Jefferson said, okay, let's go and meet, but how about if you stop first in Philadelphia and meet with all that bunch that is down there? I mean, he was referring to the members of the Philosophical Society of America, that happened to be the top society of scientists. Probably it was the only one, but it was like the society of scientists to belong in that in 1904 at least. So he went there, and then he shared a lot of his knowledge with those people, and those people shared a lot of his knowledge back, and then they were talking, and then somebody organized a trip to Washington to meet President Jefferson, and then In Washington, President Jefferson said, okay, you have the information, you have your field notes. What are you going to do with those? Oh, I'm going to publish them. Do you mind if I have a copy of your field notes? And then von Humboldt said, not at all. You can have my field notes like that. But, I mean, they are all written down in Spanish because I had to give a copy to the Spanish viceroys and captains and stuff. So, in 3 weeks, I'm going to translate all of these notes to French. But he only included the ones from Mexico, because if had he included the ones from the whole thing, he had spent there probably 4 years. So he gave the information to President Jefferson, and President Jefferson archive that information there for the future, because down there they were more busy in getting to know that land to the Pacific. And actually, by then, four months before von Humboldt arrived to Washington, Lewis and Clark had departed from St. Louis in their crazy expedition to the west. So, well, okay, let's I'm going to stop talking about like those stories and talk about specimens, because after I start doing the research, just because I was wondering, one day I was walking down back to my house, and then I was thinking on Bon Combo. And then I was thinking, okay, this guy did a lot and lots and lots of collecting. And then I was asking myself, well, where did the specimens go? And then I said, well, for sure they went to Germany. But I was doing the search, and it happened that Bonpland, I mean, he was a French citizen, he took 6,000 of those specimens back to Paris, to the Museum to that place, to the Museum of Natural History in Paris. That is still standing. I think that this is still the same, very, very same building that those guys constructed in the late 1700s.
So I have a question. Hang on. When we were in Paris a year ago, I guess, the plant building was being totally redone. Right across the mall. Well, first of all, the big main public museum is at one end of the mall, and then
the Galerie des Zoologies.
Yeah, and then next to that, when we were there, was the plant building, the botanical building. It was closed.
I think that's been under construction.
Under modeling, remodeling.
Yeah.
So down there in that building, in the old one, Bonpland took like 6,000 specimens, which were like most of the specimens that they have. Another chunk was taken back to the Berlin Botanical Garden, because you know down there in Berlin there was one of von Humboldt's mentors. So he said, okay, professor, let me say, because it's hard for me. Wildenow was his advisor. Well, not his advisor, but he took botany from Wildenow. And Wildenow happened to be one of the editors of those volumes in which they describe species as every page was like contained like the description of three or four species. And that's what he did basically. So a chunk was taken to Paris, and the other chunk was taken back to Berlin. So you get that material, and this is only the botanical material, was split in parts. The zoological material was taken to Berlin, to the zoological place. But okay, I didn't do that much research on that, because I was more kind of focused on the plants. So, okay, you can imagine that these were the first Europeans going to the Middle America, and then from everything from what is now Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, northern Bolivia, Peru, Mexico, Cuba, and parts of Panama. So all the plants that were known and had been collected, they had taken them back to Europe. So they get with their stuff, I mean, just like their gigantic logs. They put it there, and then they start splitting the material. Most of them goes to Paris, and some other goes to Berlin. Then you might expect that lots of duplicates might have been sorted, right? Like some materials goes to Paris, and some materials goes to Berlin. And then you get like people were working in two different books. Like they were basically doing the same thing, but in two different places. Actually, both people were based in Germany, because as I said, Germany was kind of like the top place. If you wanted to do something in science, you would go out there, if you would endure the life. So basically, lots of synonyms were created, and lots of synonyms were like taking the minds of our botanist fellows, until probably 1955, in which they started sorting out the publication dates of those books that we were talking about, the Nova Genera and the Systema Vegetalium. they were actually putting dates and establishing the priority of those publications, thus establishing the priority of the names. And then they were also like saying, okay, sorting the things by identifying specific specimens with specimens in the museum.
Do you know if Bay is still alive?
I don't know. I just like read that from, I don't know, Isabel. Did you get to know him?
No, I reviewed a couple of his grant proposals though while I was working as a reviewer for NSF, and it was, I think he was about 85 and he was still doing field work in Mexico. And that was about 5 years ago or 7 years ago. So I don't know if he's still kicking it out, but it'd be interesting to know. It's just prolific.
See, I mean, here you can see, this is a taxonomic book or a taxonomic paper. If you're not a taxonomist and if you start just like delving into these kind of things, you're going to get bored in the first two pages. But you could have seen that this guy put like so much passion into it, and he was explaining the things like, yeah, I don't know, I mean, he was, I mean, a very correct, a very good writer. And he was establishing all the facts there for you to understand the thing that I almost read, the entire thing, except the last paragraph in which I said, okay, I have more than the information that I need, so I don't need to keep going. And I need like a glass of water, and then I get home. So basically, he was sorting out this material. And he found out that lots of the specimens taken to Germany were lost in the war. Because, I mean, some of the buildings happened to be bombed. And he claims, and McBath claims, until he says that he doesn't have any proof, that the Russians took like several of those things away with them back to their Soviet Empire. So that's what they did. And destroy stuff.
That's why Reagan referred to them as an evil empire. He thought it was communism.
Those plants.
It was the best plants.
Yeah. And we still don't have the plants back.
I know. It's maybe now that we have this new agreement, things will change.
Well, other little trivial comments, though. You hear in the art community, and I don't know where the data from this support this statement comes from, but you hear that at least 95% of all artworks have been destroyed in the past, at least 95%. So that if you rely on art as your sense of culture, your reflection of culture at the time, then you're looking at only 5% of the evidence. Now, the rest of the 95% evidence might tell you exactly the same thing about what people wore and their relationships. But if you go back to all of that Egyptian tomb art, for example, and how much cultural information is embedded in that stuff, then you realize we have this picture of ancient Egypt, and you have pictures, and in a similar way, you really have pictures of the Dark Ages and the Renaissance based on so much of that art, and it's all been destroyed. And I think Rich Kloffman, one of the things that he ran across when he was here was the statement of an old Obata, a Japanese guy working on Gregorians, who had written in one of his taxonomic papers that all of his specimens were destroyed in the atomic bomb attack on Hiroshima, and that after the war he had started over all again. So that was such a dramatic statement from in a taxonomic work by a real scientist. I pulled that out and put it in as one of those epigraphs in the Foundations books for Chapter 8.
Yeah, that's okay. But it's only for Gregorians, right? So you wouldn't accept any other thing for mammals?
Well, I have no idea what else was destroyed.
This wasn't related to the bombings in Japan. This was related to the museum in Lisbon. Back when the French invaded Lisbon, I mean, they were just like, okay, let's just like put everything on fire except the specimens. And then they could take the specimens and ship them back to to Paris. I mean, that's basically why lots of like species from the eastern coast of France that was of Brazil that was inaccessible for anyone in the world was kind of like really well known for these French guys. And afterwards, I mean, lots of Germans went there, and then they started really sending stuff to Austria and Berlin, and then they start describing like mammals, birds, parasites. And those Germans didn't have anything else to do.
What was the basis for the scientific interest on the part of the imperialistic governments of the 1800s and earlier? I mean, what was the status in collecting specimens from Lisboa and taking them to Paris?
All of the quinine expeditions and thievery and all the medical stuff and the exploitations involving quinine all happened before that, but not in the too distant past. That's one of them. That may be part of the interest in botany, but I mean the herbal as a medical publication, that has a deep history that goes way back, really back even into the Dark Ages, I think. Before the Renaissance, yeah.
The economic botany competition.
Economic botany. I mean, that's been a staple in biological history going back easily 1,000 years, maybe 1,500.
That's true.
One of the more interesting things, you know, all these publications come into our house, and two of the main ones that Karen gets are Art in America and Art News. And in one of those, there was this big, long article about the Iraq War and the resignation and departure of the Baghdad Museum director, who has just simply given up on trying to preserve what's left of the Baghdad Museum and the big museum in Baghdad. But the point being made that of all the museums in the world that really have the hardcore evidence about the origins of culture, that's the one. That's the one that has in there. I know that I've been in museums in Europe or in other places where there are these artifacts from the Sumerian artifacts. There are 6,000 BC clay imprint scroll makers and all of this stuff, and it all comes really from that Tigris and Euphrates region. And it's that museum that in which the record of the origin of urban civilization, at least this side of China, that's where it is.
Or was.
Was.
I heard that story also on NPR, but a while back ago.
Yeah.
I mean that they were like really worried, and especially the community of like museum people in Europe were trying to find ways to support and actually physically protect that building, because during one of those times the director was saying, well, one day we just like gave up, and then the bombings were so bad that we just like run away, and then the day after the bombings were like everything was calm, we came back and lots of people had entered and taken away stuff already. So I don't know, probably we might find it on an antique map.
eBay,
exactly.
But I want one of those shirts on eBay.
Okay, and that is another thing that another point that I wanted to make. I mean, these expeditions and these collections actually worth money. I mean, if they don't worth money in terms of, okay, I'm just going to go and say the administration, okay, this worth money, because that could be so kind of like blind for me. I mean, it worth more than money, but actually giving and providing that checklist of rocks that you're going to have in an area, of plants that you're going to have, the parasites that you're going to have, is going to give you an accurate inventory of the things that they have. Coming back to Dave's garage thing, okay, if you were like in a mind of, okay, we are going to conquer the world, if you were Chinese right now, what were you trying to collect besides resources?
Well, they're linked to resources.
So the only thing that you care for is resources. So the only thing that if I was Chinese, I would be thinking, okay, let's start making a checklist of who's have whose resources. In that way, we can actually trade with those people. Or if they are not nice enough, we can go and invade them. We are Chinese. We overnumber them. Well, hopefully they don't think that way, but it might happen. So that's actually one of the values. And I think that was one of the purposes that or the ideas that Carlos IV had in Spain, to let these people go. Okay, go and actually tell me what is in there, because these idiots that I have as viceroys, I mean, just tell me that there is lots of money and good life and people. But they couldn't provide the details. And that's exactly, or that's the transition that we have to make to this collection in which we are standing and we are working on, and that we have here. So this is just a bare number of the lots that we have as of today. The last accession was made by Dr. Matt Pollitt, who donated four slides, including Hematolycus worms from his beloved frogs.
What is a lot?
That's a very good question, and I would refer you to the curator of this collection to define that.
A lot, since we cannot actually count the number of individual specimens that we have in the collection, because there's so many hundreds of thousands and millions of specimens, individuals, we call them lots. We have one bottle can have anything from 1 to 1,000 or 10,000 specimens in it. So one bottle is called a lot instead of an individual specimen. And the Smithsonian had done a quick survey. They found that their lots were between 10 and 100 specimens. So basically we have 38,000 lots with between 10 and 100 specimens in each lot.
So if we take Matt's donation, okay, Matt presented four species coming from four different frogs from four different places. So for this purpose, each of those slides gets an HWML number, and it's a lot, individual lot. Excuse me, but in this case, it's only one. This is the easiest most of our kind of like definitions. But like, for instance, in like, say the mountain lions that they have been collecting, they just like, they could be infected by like 40 tinea formis, by 48 like Toxascaris leonina, and those are gonna go in a single vial that are gonna include like those 46 individuals, and that is gonna be a lot. So a lot is like this plastic concept that floats in the air. But I mean, it's basically an entry. So the foundations for the collections were basically the expeditions that Dr. Manter himself performed, did, and set up and worked and identified the specimens that he collected in the South Pacific. The first numbers that you can collect are those ones that he was identifying that came from fish from the Americas Pacific. I mean, in Americas, I mean Galapagos Islands. There are some others from Mexico. There were a lot from Mexico, a lot from Ecuador, and few others from Florida, from the Tortugas station. So from then, and from that moment on, he used like say, okay, the Pacific is like so extends that we need to go and keep sure the materials are. So he organized expeditions by himself in the middle of the winter to go to the South Pacific and start collecting. He, I don't know, do you know if Marie-Louis, if he had any help in the field?
Pardon me?
Do you know if Dr. Manter had any help in the field, any assistant helping him dissecting the parasites, fixing them, preserving them?
Sometimes
or most of the time?
Some.
Okay, but like, okay, he would like take his crew and stuff. Basically, the collection started growing from the specimens that he collected in the South Pacific, including, I mean, the Australia, New Zealand, mainly New Zealand, and the surrounding seas. From that, we kept growing by acquiring other collections from Dr. Cable, Dr. Self, and McDonald's, that were one of the really some of the collections that increased the number of specimens that we have here, and sometimes almost double the thing, depending on the time period in which you are actually taking a reference for.
So I need to tell you this story about the Self collections.
Okay.
There was a postdoc working in my lab named Gerald Kudish, who I wish you all could have known Gerald Kudish. He was one of the most remarkable people. I think he's now, he may have worked for the CIA before he went back to graduate school, and he acted like it. And he may be at Plum Island right now working on biological warfare. But when it came time for Self to deliver those collections, we rented a van and drove down to Oklahoma to get them. And we stopped in a little town in Blackwell or somewhere in northern Oklahoma to eat lunch. And the University of Nebraska had just beaten OU in a football game, and